Slugs. Madness everywhere, and not a drop to drink. Madness, madness everywhere. Well, you know, that's true. You'd be surprised at how many people think your life is irrelevant if you find anything funny about life. It's just a fact. Oh, yes. It's a fact. Oh, by the way, speaking of irrelevance and relevance, you don't mind the relevance which you prefer, do you ever have a sneaking suspicion that if Nero were alive today, he would be playing his hi-fi while Rome burns? You know? I suspect Nero. Speaking of Nero, I'm in a restaurant today. It's just eerie, you know? I'm sitting in a restaurant not more than a half an hour ago. Today, this evening, I'm going out to lunch, dinner, you see. And, of course, my world is all topsy-turvy because this time, you know, the day when I'm on, that's the middle of the day for me. You got to understand that, friends. And so I'm out there having lunch. And who do you think is sitting at the next table? The Erie. I'm sitting there. This nice retro. Give me a little of that elegant music. The elegant music. That's right. The elegant music. Right. Cut three. Bring it in. The elegant music. That ain't that little 10-incher. Come on. There we go. There I am, you know, just innocently sitting. Hi, Art. How are you, Dad? Gee whiz. It's been a long time. I see Art's got his glasses changed. He can see me again. Hi. Good to see you, Art. We're still here. Cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha. Cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha. Well, I'm sitting in this restaurant. Hey, I'm minding my own business. And, of course, it's just a little restaurant. It's not really such a little restaurant, but it's just a little way off Broadway, right in the middle of the heart of the Passion District of New York. Madness all around. You really see it, right? And Times Square is quite possibly the most enscapulated. It's a capsule version, yes. That means enscapulate, meaning it's made into a capsule. That'll be in the next semester. You'll understand that more next year. And, however, I'm sitting there just off Times Square. Do you remember the radio show the guy used to say, and now the little theater just off Times Square? And the first nighter steps out of his car, boop, 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 smoking in the outer lobby only, please, smoking. Well, I'm sitting in a little restaurant just off Times Square, Showbizville, of course. And it's, good food. I'm... paying attention only to my scintillating table correspondence, when all of a sudden I'm aware that at the next table is a familiar figure. Where have I seen him before? Where have I seen him before?
He's bearded, too.
And he's Rabelaisian. And he's laughing, drinking wine, talking to the tables all around him. He is in the highest of good Jovian spirits. It's the Emperor Nero. It is Nero. I'm not exaggerating. It is Nero. Do you hear me, Art? It was Nero. I had seen Nero, this Nero. I had seen him in a movie not more than 6 weeks before, and he was the Emperor Nero. And here all the while, I thought, you know, Rome is burning all around me. And incidentally, if you think that's irrelevant, what I'm saying to your friends, you haven't been out lately. All around me, the population is rising. The world, the land, the society is in flames. In all of his majesty, in all of his imperial glory, was the Emperor Nero, drinking a sparkling Alsatian wine and making jokies with the crowds around him as he sat in his Rabelaisian seat. I felt like asking him, hey, where's your fiddle? How about a tune? Marching, 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 man, struggling against the forces that lie within him like great untapped dragons of passion. Marching, 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 ever on, struggling ever upward, sliding sideways and then struggling forward again, digging his toenails in. And the winds howl from out of the north and out of the west and out of the east. And underneath them, the great, great schisms of the earth roar, the giant, giant forces beyond forces. Great Scott. And here you thought you were going to get Lawrence Welk. But somewhere, someplace, in that far-off land that we all are striving for, that magnificent utopia of the spirit. The soft, sweet breezes blow over the Bay of Profundity. That's enough of that. That'll keep him going for a while. You want a little more of that? You like that, huh? Well, you know who was sitting at the next table? It really was Nero. I will give you a brass figligy with bronze oak leaf palm if you can tell me who it was who played Nero in this movie that I'm talking about. And he was actually sitting at the next table looking just like Nero. He played himself in that movie. He looked just like Nero. And all the while, I could hear the crowd hooting and hollering outside. You know, they were laying mortar shells down on Hackensack. And, you know, it's kind of right that I should see Nero at the next table, just 250 feet off Times Square. Who was it? All right, I'll award your brass figligy. Let me know. And if you think this is irrelevant, friend, you don't know, you don't know the world the way it is. And speaking of irrelevance, you know, the other night, see, I go to these, there's this madness going on everywhere. See, I go to these people's houses and you know, it's kind of a hip people, I thought, anyway. And in the middle of, we're having a great conversation, you know, about life and the way the world is going and the whole bit, when all of a sudden they says, oh, wait a minute, just a minute, hold it. Got to get the TV set on. Got to watch this great thing we always watch. I said, what the hell could it be? So wait a minute, hold it. And they rush the TV set and they turn it on. And, of course, you can see, you know, there are certain channels that don't come in very well on most TV sets, you know, like, you know, Channel 47 and all that. So they turned to this channel, you know, snow is coming down. It's Channel 13, see, and it's barely making it through into their set. And I realize all of a sudden the top of my head is going to sleep. And with the world in flames all around me, I'm watching the Galsworthy saga. What? Well, you just don't have the kind of friends I run into. The Galsworthy saga. You know who the Galsworthy saga is? It's, you know, Galsworthy? You mean you haven't seen it on Channel 13? You never watch Channel 13, I see. Your set is stuck between 2 and 4. You get 3 in real good, huh? Well, nevertheless, here I'm watching this saga, the Forsyte saga by Galsworthy. And my head starts to, oh, my, you know, my head is going bad right there in front of me, because the Galsworthy saga, the Forsyte saga, is one of the worst experiences in my growing days. I happen to have a teacher one time. I don't think I've ever really discussed her very much. Have I? Miss Fife? Well, you've heard me make passing references to Miss Fife, but Miss Fife was pseudo-English. You know, like today, there are pseudo-intellectuals. Have you ever noticed that anybody you disagree with is a pseudo-intellectual? I mean, you know, if the only real intellectual, I guess, is your type, I mean, but nevertheless, we have all kinds of pseudo-intellectuals, pseudo-radical, pseudo-this and pseudo-that. Hardly any real things. They're all pseudo-liberals. That's another one, too. And so, anyway, I'm a pseudo-pseudo. And so I'm sitting there, see, with the pseudo-English type, and I was going through a session with an early pseudo-English-ophile, Anglophile. Yeah, she was a real cuckoo about English, and she came from Goshen, Indiana, and that's not an easy place to come from when you're, a cuckoo on England, and everything that was English was groovy to her, or at least pseudo-English, and so she assigned to all of us to read, in our eighth grade, in grade school, the entire Forsyte saga. Well, now, if you've ever read the Forsyte saga, you know that this is one of the most blindingly boring books ever written in the history of man. And it makes an even more blindingly boring series on TV. But nevertheless, it's what it is. It's English soap opera. It is, guys are continually having affairs with the maid, and they're clutching at their breast constantly. Oh, Forsyte, Mr. Soames, you do not realize that your nephew has developed amnesia while he was at the military college in Kent, and he has run away with the gardener's daughter, Alicia, and they were last seen. Well, I want to tell you, at the age of whatever it is when you're in eighth grade, I developed a permanent buzz right over here, over my right ear, when anyone mentions John Galsworthy. I read the entire Forsyte saga and had to take a test on it. So I'm sitting here in the middle of this living room scene. These people, you don't mind if I tell you this obscene recollection of life in the 20th century, do you? Which reminds me, this is WOR. Oh, yes, and people are on the march everywhere, every place. Here they come.
Don, I am speaking to you from a deserted field somewhere in the western United States. As I look around, I can see the men and mechanics of Dr. Pepper waiting anxiously around their trucks. Eddie, Dr. Pepper's most veteran driver, stands near the fire as the kid, his first run before him, turns and says,
Gee, Eddie, I hope there won't be any trouble.
Don't worry, kid.
Dawn is beginning to lighten the eastern sky as everyone waits to hear the final words from the captain before they leave for New York.
Men of the Dr. Pepper Squadron, this is the captain. You have all received your orders. The road ahead will not be easy, but knowing you as I have, I am confident that despite the pitfalls and misunderstandings each of you shall face, you shall take Dr. Pepper to New York in victory. Nothing can stop us now.
There you have it. The trucks are speeding off with the words of the captain ringing in the ears of every driver. Dr. Pepper's coming to New York, May 18th. Nothing can stop us now.
And the Dr. Pepper blitzkrieg moves out into the dawn. Dust rises under the crunching treads of the enormous T-74 tanks. The Dr. Pepper invasion is on. I just had to do that. I'm sorry. Reset that, will you? Yeah, man. Did anybody recognize Nero? Was he fantastic in that movie? Because, you know, he has an epicene character. And it helps. And it really does help. And I saw Nero sitting at the next table. And he was not wearing exactly a toga, but he was wearing a toga look. And, helps just as much. And so here I am in the middle of all this, that's one of the great things. You wouldn't see that in Goshen, Indiana, Nero at the next table. You'd actually be working for Nero in Goshen. But that's another story. So nevertheless, this lady arrives, Miss Fife, on this nice, quiet day in spring. It was about this time of the year, It was about 6 or 7 weeks before the end of the semester, just before we were graduate. She sprung it on us. We'd been reading the usual jazz, you read in eighth grade, like Treasure Island, stuff like that, when all of a sudden she holds up this gigantic, fat book. I'll tell you, it's so fat, it comes with handles on it. You can't just carry it. It comes in a big carrying case you put over your shoulder. And she says that we're going to all have to read this. She says, I'm going to introduce you to good literature. Well, she had this fake English accent that she had developed in Indiana, and she said, good literature. Well, okay. So, you got to start that stuff, someday, I guess. I mean, it's like, I suppose you have to start taking geritol someday. So, nevertheless, she comes in with these books and passes them out. She got them from the school system, the library system. She had too many of them. She had enough for every one of us, which, didn't even give you a cop-out that you didn't have the book. So each one of us got this gigantic assembled volume of the total works of Galsworthy, or at least the Galsworthy saga, starting in Soames's days as a young man. And as you know, he lived 107 years. And you have to read each word. Well, it permanently put a crease right over my right ear. And, the Forsyth saga, if I remember, the saga is it three volumes or 103? Five. Well, that's only academic. That's truly academic. Well, now, here I find large numbers of people are sitting on their duffs all over the place, watching it on television. That's like, I'll tell you what Galsworthy reminds me of. Galsworthy reminds me of an English 19th century male Rona Jaffe. He really does. Endless ringing, and sneaking around the back stairs and endless intrigues in the weeds next to the boathouse. I just figured it's that time of the year. Speaking of that time of the year, I talked to a lady here at the station. See, of course, summertime is as you notice, Shepherd is full of pizzazz tonight. Well, it's the summer, I flower the summertime because the sun beats down on top of my head and I feel the sprouts coming out. You'll notice little vines growing under my arms and twigs are coming out and buds and stuff. Well, that's the way it happens. You see, it's a period of total reawakening. And it is. It just opens up everything. The pores are opened up. You're running around. Well, I'm not alone in this because we've got this nice lady at the station who answers calls from angry kooks that call up. That's her job. That's all she does. And there's a certain sound in the voice of a kook that you can tell right away. We have, we have kook detectors that are electronic, never make a mistake, fully electronic on our switchboard. And they're automatically rooted into this lady's office. And she's been at this job for 107 years. She went on just about the time that Old Man Gambling was starting his first exercise show. Bell went to work taking these calls. So she's seen it all. She's been through every known human hallucination. She's wandered through the garden of human perversity. I'll tell you, it's unbelievable. She's seen it all. You do after a while. So I walk up to the, and you see him sitting in the lobbies here. There's always about nine kooky-looking types with flowers growing out of their ears. See, they're here. They want to see somebody angry about, that the vegetarians are rampant or who knows what. The tax are, the cats are attacking her on 12th Street. It just goes on and on. It never stops. So Oh, no, no. The supply of human loonies is practically endless. In fact, I would say, without fear of stepping on too many toes, is endless. Oh, yes, we got... There's one lady who is under the impression, lives in Jersey, she's under the impression that I am daily flying over her house, flirting with her from an airplane. And she's getting sick and tired of it. She believes... she seriously believes this. And she believes that the neighbors are getting wise to the fact that I am doing this. Well, you know, this... When you run into this kind of, the outpouring of the loony bin is everywhere. So you get so you're kind of used to it in New York, because almost every loony in the country who has been ostracized in this town because he is a loony, hops the first greyhound for Manhattan, where he then disappears into anonymity, see, and takes to writing angry letters to Lindsay. However, but nevertheless, she said today, I said to her, well, how are things going, Belle? And she's sitting at her desk. She's got the loony department. It says right there on her desk. So I said, how are you, Belle? And she said, well, it's fine. I says, nice day, isn't it, Belle? Yes. And I said, boy, I sure love the summer. She said, oh, yes. She says, all the loonies are out. They come into flower, you know. They come with the crocuses. And she said that right in front of about seven of them were sitting there with their petitions to Barry Farber, you see, to stamp out the ant population of Trenton, New Jersey, that they're, you know, the ants are working for the John Birch Society or something. Oh, yeah, we had one lady up here who argued for years that you keep coming up here every week arguing that we're being anti-insect. Yeah, you know, we had a couple of insecticide spots on the station, so she said that you're being anti... It's very bad, and she loved insects, and she says the reason that insects harass people is that we're not kind to them. And she says, you talk to the insects, and you discuss it with them, and they'll leave. She says, whenever the ants come into her house, all she has to do is talk to them very nicely and say, this is my house, and you live out there. Now, there's your house. Now, I don't come into your anthill. And if you don't come into my house, let's think of it as my anthill. And I won't come into your anthill if you stay out of my anthill. Now, here's a little piece of sugar ant. Now, you go right back home and tell your friends that any time they're really hungry, they can come. But please stay out when I have guests. Well, she believed this strongly. And it's very hard for Martha Dean to handle her. She wanted to Indian wrestle Martha Dean. So, you know, you run into this from time to time. And, of course, it gets even better in the summertime. And, I wandered through. What's the moon? Of course, I mean it's a combination of the moon, the tides, the warmer temperatures. Of course, the hibernation period is over. The man is a hibernating creature. He really is partly hibernating, and all winter we hibernate. You know, all the other animals, they stay out. You know that we are a hibernating creature. All right, I'll explain to you what I mean by that. That other animals winter and summer stay out in the cold. If it's hot, they stay out in the hot. If it's cold, they stay in the cold. The deer, for example, does not hibernate. He stays right out there in the wind. Horses do not hibernate in nature. There's only a few creatures that take to the cover, and sort of hole up all winter, during the winter. They really do hole up. We are a hibernating creature. Well, you know what bears do. As soon as they get out of their long sleep, they look for action. That's right. And they do. They really look for you. If you've ever been around any area where the bears have just come out of hibernation, they're looking for a lot of stuff. And, man, they'll find it. You hear them yelling and hollering in the woods. There's more action for about the first 3 months after they get out of hibernation than the whole year put together. Well, see, man is just coming out of his hibernation now. And he's stretching his everything. You know, you stretch your head, your muscles, your mind, the whole bit, you know. And, you can just feel it. It's flowing through you. The cuckoo birds are calling up like men. Even the cuckoo birds, they go into hibernation, too. There's this brief periods of sanity they have. And this often comes about, you know. Oh, yes, we know these things. And, you know, I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't actually seen it, you know, myself. You know, before I hung around mass communication areas, I would have... There are a lot of things... don't want to get into old metaphysics, do we? I know. Don't you remember who metaphysics was? She's that old movie star. She was fantastic. You know, wore these beads hanging down over her eyes and all that stuff in the silent films. Yeah, you see, they have occasional film festivals at the, you know, Museum of Modern Art. But that's another world, too, you know. To get yourself to actually go to see a Ginger Rogers film festival requires a certain amount of, you know, cuckoo-ness right there. But the 601, oh, no, I'm just these are all coming out of the top of my head, see. Oh, there comes another one. Another idea just came out. Yes, sir, died of boarding. Born of dieting. But nonetheless, 601, half a dozen the other. I always say, that's an old wives' tale. Give me a little more of that elegant music, please. And the old wives march on. And the moon rises higher, higher and higher, above the benighted horizon of a strife-torn world. Cool and limpid, casting its pale blue light upon the serrated world of man. All right, bring it up, solid. No, that's all right, tell it's okay. Marching forward. Hey, that's kind of nice, isn't it? Sing to me sweet songs. Pluck your lutes. Play your violin, oh Nero. Oh, that's very nice. Thank you. Reset that, if you will, please, Martin. We will use that again. I have a question. What happened to Lee? She's disappeared. Oh, she's getting... Oh, that won't do you any good. A little one little paper. That's no good. Get out of here, baby. I mean, I appreciate your efforts, but... I knocked my coffee all over the desk. That's not my coffee. It was last week's John Gambling coffee. Here. There it goes. All right, that's all. Hey, listen, I'm going to ask a question here, if I may. I want an honest answer. No, I don't want to. I don't want to mess around here while I'm doing the show. Leave it go. Now, come on, get out of here, will you? Please. I mean, what do you want? You know, I'm going to have to quote those miserable cigarette ads that say, what do you want, bad English or good taste? Which do you want? Do you want a good show or do you want a clean desk? By the way, isn't that great? Isn't that great commercial? That's typical commercial logic. It seems that if you have good English in your commercials, you cannot make a cigarette that tastes good. I mean, you got to have one or the other. You have bad English, you have good taste. Personally, I've never tasted a cigarette that did taste good, you know. One way or the other. No, they don't have any taste, you know, really, to be honest with you. But I have a question I want to ask, a serious question. One person identified Nero, didn't he? Oh, three identified Nero. Oh, really? Oh, get out of here. That's impossible. I refuse to accept that. We just had the report that four people identified Nero. And one of them said, Terence O'Toole. I never heard of an actor named Terence. Is there a Terence O'Toole who acts? Well, that's the name of every English actor, Terence O'Toole. And, but nevertheless, you know, the Anglophile that is galloping in our world today is very rampant. It's here, we've got David Frost now doing a TV show, see, and he sits around and, you know, he puts America down. He comments about America and discusses the disintegration. Can you imagine an American doing a show like that on the BBC about Britain? Oh, they wouldn't buy it. No, not at all. And they would be enraged. But, you know, that's, you know, there's a little passing thing. You don't mind if I throw rocks around occasionally. And I know David. He's very nice. I've known him for a long time. I knew him before he made it. Did you know that? He was called Mr. Frosty in those days. Made ice cream bars and stuff. Now he's, you know, he's gone straight. But I did. I knew him. I'm sorry. He was. He really was. He did a kid's show, and he called himself Mr. Frosty. And everybody says, oh, what do you mean? What a bad funny that is. Yeah, it was a bad funny, even when he did it. So, you know, a lot of things are bad funnies, but true. Nevertheless, well, I'm telling you, I'm giving it to you tonight. You know, I'll tell you, I'm delighted, though, that somebody did identify Nero, and he was sitting at the next table, which I thought was kind of nice, since I had just been thinking about the burning of Rome. Who was Nero? Well, it was Peter Ustinov. And, Peter Ustinov played Nero. Was a great Nero, actually. Best thing in that picture. He was so epicene. And he kept saying, "Oh, all of you terrible ministers and that, you keep coming around bothering me with all this affairs of state when I want to practice my violin." Oh, man. But, of course, he played Billy Budd, too, which was the other... Or he played the captain in Billy Budd, which is the other end of the scale. However, I have a question, a serious question I want to ask you. You don't mind if I get relevant tonight. It's a very serious question. You see little sad moments in life that have nothing to do with people, actually, and have more to do with things. I think that much sadness can be seen in people's things. I mean, seriously, more than people. If you look at an old, worn shoe, that often is sadder than the person who actually wore the shoe and says more about him than he and his own person would say. You follow what I'm saying there? That if somehow the things that people surround themselves with can be infinitely sad or infinitely funny, depending on how you look at it. Well, the other day I'm walking through the halls here, and somebody has been cleaning out an office. And somebody's whole life was thrown out. I'd like to know what happened there. There was a big framed picture of the assembled class of 1920 from CCNY in a frame, big frame. And it had pictures of all the different guys, each one individual with their names under it. And it says, "Graduating class, City College of New York, the year 1920. Beautiful handwritten words and all, old English calligraphy and everything, and it was being thrown out, frame and all. Now, I figured, somebody must have, something must have happened, and they just threw this guy's life away. His class was going down the drain with old used Kleenexes and, Fresca cans and all that jazz. Down was gone. Probably the only surviving picture of the assembled class of the College of the City College of New York, 1920. And I couldn't let it go. I took it right out of the... Yeah, I pulled it right out. I haven't done this in a long time. I pulled it right out of the garbage, and I said to the lady, I says, "You're throwing this away." She said, "Yes, so we are throwing it away." And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "What, somebody are throwing it away out of the office." There's a whole group of gnomes who work in New York offices who speak no known language. And so you have to, you communicate by some kind of language, waving your arms and stuff. And so, you laugh, and then she'll laugh, stuff like that. So... I took this picture, and she says, "Oh, good, good, good." And I says, "Good, good, bueno, bueno." She says, no, speak it, no, speak Spanish, Spanish, Espanola, no. And I says, "Good, good, Espanol, New York, Spanish, Kedvish, Hagatab." I hollered all known languages I've got, and she kept going, yeah. So I took the picture, and I put it in my office. Now I've got a picture of the class of 1920, graduating class of the City College of New York in my office. I'm sorry to say, there it is. Is there anybody wants it out there? We could give it a good home. I think this is a fantastic piece of camp. It's beautiful frame. It's got glass. And, there it is. It's a great piece of camp to have in your office, especially if you're a dynamic, hard-hitting, long sideburn type that just got out. You have this big picture back you, and they look so elegant. Every one of them looks a little bit like F. Scott Fitzgerald around the eyes, I have a feeling that the times really affect people's look. I mean, the actual look of their faces, they look different. Have you ever seen those Matthew Brady pictures of the Civil War? And you see these pictures of these men's faces, all these soldiers and so on. And they have that look about them in the eyes. I don't know. They're unmistakable of that period. Have you noticed that? They don't look like you wouldn't. Now, really seriously think about it before you say, that there is a look around their eyes and their face, because the times do affect the look on a face of your look, your general outlook on things. And I see these pictures of Matthew Brady, and I say, this is a Civil War guy. He's got the look in the eyes. The eyes are kind of shadowed, and they're usually deeper set or something. There's a curious kind of melancholy about them if you see these people. And then Then, have you seen the pictures of the guys around the time of World War One? The soldiers, U.S. the soldiers, pictures of World War One soldiers. They have a very different look on their face. They've got a kind of open-eyed. Their eyes are wide open, sort of open-eyed, Jimmy Cagney kind of look. You know, it's a look. It's definitely a look. And then you see pictures of guys in the 20s, people like F. Scott Fitzgerald. And they too have a look that's unmistakably, you know, part of their scene. And that we, of course, of our time, walking around the streets in 1970, we have a look on our face which we don't even recognize, I'm sure, you know, because it's so much part of it. It's our look. It's our time, you know. And years later, like say 40 or 50 years from now, people will look at pictures of crowds walking along Fifth Avenue or walking along a street in Bayonne, New Jersey or something, and you'll see cars and that in the background. And we will be period people then. It will be, you know, it'll be a period picture. And it will look like the old times. People will say, look, you know, they really have that look. You know, they have a 20th century look about them. And it's just a look around the eyes. Are you ever conscious of this? Do you ever think about this? Well, you know we have this look, and I think that our times, which are turbulent, wild times, our times are producing people who have a curious kind of almost the same melancholy look that guys had during the Civil War. You walk along the Fifth Avenue, for example, and you'll see endless numbers of people. You know, you go for days walking along Fifth, and you will hardly see anybody smile. There's a somberness, a somber quality. In spite of the fact that all of our movies are supposed to be side-splitting satires and stuff, the people generally are somber. People distrust laughter. You know, I'll get a lot of letters from people many times during the year who seem to think laughter is irrelevant in times of stress. I get these letters all the time, and actually to me, laughter is more needed now than at any time, you know. But that's, you know, personal opinion. And yet you see the somber look. You'll get in front of a class, for example. I do a lot of college things. And there's hardly a, you know, the people have got a kind of curious kind of, it's that melancholy. It's quality. And it's very much the same look that you see on old World War, or rather old Civil War pictures. Because they had gone through an extended period of strife, fantastic internal strife, in America at that time, and it affected all our lives. Whereas I think the reason why guys look so open, Jimmy Cagney, you know, get my regards to Broadway, this look of World War One, which was a sort of happy-go-lucky, like a bunch of kids out on a party look, was because America had just gone through practically a whole generation of people who knew no trouble. There had been no wars or anything, you know, and going off to war to those guys was like a song and dance, and it was a whole big lark, and so I don't know, I just wonder about that look in the eye, and I wonder how our eyes are going to look to people, who you know could look at a picture of us 50 years from now. As a matter of fact, you know, have you noticed when you look at old movies that are about the period of about 1940, 41, 42, how different the people looked. Not just the clothing, but they really looked different. There was a different look about them. They're I don't know how to describe it. And I suspect that one of the great peculiar side dividends of the technological world is you can really preserve history. As you know, maybe 50 or 60 years ago, the past really was the past to people in those days, because the art of photography was just very new, and there were no movies that would be, there were no movies, for example, of, let's say, charges at Bull Run. We have no movies of the Civil War, and so this was just the beginning. The 20th century marked the beginning where you could preserve right on film. You could preserve history. You could rerun it again, over and over and over again. And you can rerun Pearl Harbor if you want to. There are endless feet of films of the bombings of Pearl Harbor, and you can sit and watch them. You can see the people flying the Japanese Zeros, flying the Bettys, The guy's going up in their, well, what were they flying? P-36s, trying to fight them. And this is a fascinating concept. You can sit at night, late at night, and you can watch Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland, and they're going to one of these Never Never high schools, you know, where they're always eternally. The biggest problem is the widow Butts. Her son has this rare disease, and they've got to go and get the serum from someplace in the big city. And so let's put on a show. And Donald O'Connor comes in. So he says, "Let's put on a show." And Mickey says, "I'll tell you what. Okay, you get your uncle's tap dance suit, and I know you can't tap dance, but you can try it. How about trying a little bit? And he goes, da-da-da-da-da-da. And by coincidence, Benny Goodman is in the neighborhood, and he decides to play at the big show. And June Pricer does her famous drum major act. And, you know, this is a whole never-never world. And yet it was probably valid pretty much at the time. Or, people wouldn't have bought it so much. It was pretty valid. And so it produces a look in the eye. And I'm just curious what posterity, and I've often been curious about it. I guess most people really aren't, but from time to time I think about this. I wonder what people are going to think 100 years from now about us. Well, don't assume that they'll think it's bad or good. I mean, it's history. It's what will they think, you know? And they'll see pictures. Can you imagine somebody seeing a picture of you? You know, you think you're hip. You know, you're really with it. And you're a 19-year-old type, you know, and you bought all your stuff down on 4th Street in the Village. And you got your General Custer jacket on and the whole shtick, you know. And 50 years from now, a guy will be looking at a picture at this, you know, at this apparition, which is you, see. And he'll say, you know, it's amazing. Gee, people really were different in those days, he will say. And they were. And they were. They will be. It will be very hard to explain now to the people in the future. Just as it is, it must be difficult for the producer of, let's say, the Andy Hardy movies today to explain it to people who are around him that this was real then. One period in time is almost always inexplicable, right? It's totally confusing to the next period, and it always looks ridiculous. I mean, the guys in the Spanish-American War, that's kind of ridiculous, you know, the charge at San Juan Hill. Yeah, history always seems ridiculous, near history. It's only far-off history that seems romantic. You know, like Napoleon's armies before the gates of Waterloo, before the gates of Moscow. This is romantic. Nobody says, what a silly, idiotic, you know, what a... Well, and so tonight I saw in a restaurant just off Times Square the Emperor Nero himself. You know, I kind of like... Well, of course, I've seen Caligula many times. I mean, there are so many Caligulas that it bothers you. You keep, you know, they're besieging the gates. I mean, don't think the horse will not get elected to Congress yet.
The New York...